Good morning. I think we'll get underway. We're missing our moderator. My name is not Karen. That may have been obvious to you at this point. I'm Robert Vaughn. I'm the president of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which has created this book festival 22 years ago, really more like 23, because the first year we were trying to get ourselves organized, we expected that we could create maybe 15 programs maximum. And that first year, we ended up with 55. So we knew we had a tiger by the tail. And the festival has gone on now. This is its 22nd year. The number of programs is 253 this year. The number of writers and people participating in the speaking parts of the program are over 400. And the writers and authors come from all over the world in these cases. Fewer the farther away you get from here. One of the unique, well, it isn't unique, it's just the expansion of something that happened this year, which I really am pleased to hear about, to know about. There are 89 writers who are visiting and speaking in schools in this area, mostly at Charlottesville, Albemarle, but even out into Nelson County or up into Orange or Greene County along the way. I just think that's an astonishing number, and it really pleases me to have that many schools participating and joining with us along the way. Also, we have on Monday morning two writers who write children's books who are going to be speaking to 2,400 second and third graders, all of whom are coming from all of the schools in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and settling into one place, and will be speaking there. We did this for the first time last year, and it was absolutely astonishing because the kids knew who the writers were. They had either known it because they'd heard about them themselves or because they had come up in school along the way. And it was a remarkable event. So if you're interested in kids and children's books and you want to come out with 2,400 second graders, it's going to be at St. Anne's Belfield in the gymnasium area, the only place in town where we could get 2,400 kids. I'm really pleased to be here. I think this is a wonderful program with subjects that clearly interest you as well. We have three quite distinguished, well-known people in the field. Trails of Tears is the title here. And because I'm not the moderator, I'm more dependent on the text than I normally would be at this point in life along the way. But I'm hoping and knowing that we're going to have a really good event today. This is supported by the Festival of the Book. People come in from all over the world along the way. We will have, you do have in your hands, I can see them now, they're sort of a lime green yellow thing, evaluation, and we would very much appreciate you filling those out because it gives us a sense of what people have liked and not liked, things that have worked and not worked, absence of moderators and presence of moderators along the way. So take a look at those. There are book sales available and you pass on the way in back in that corner. And the writers, I think, will be signing books up here in the front. That's fine. So there and come back up here along the way. The festival is free with the exception of five programs that include meals. So five out of those 253. But nonetheless, it still costs to produce. So if we can entice you to contribute to the festival so that next year's will be even better, if that's possible, than this year. Thank you very much. First speaker today is William Heath, and he is the author of William Wells and the Struggle for the Old Northwest. And he just learned, was it just today?
No, a week ago.
A week ago. That he has received two Spur Awards from the Western Writers of America for Best Nonfiction History Book and the Best First Nonfiction History Book. So I'm delighted to be able to report that to all of you along the way. His work is on the struggle for the Old Northwest, a book of history. He's published three novels. So this is his first book of history. The novels of The Children Bob Moses Led, Devil Dancer, and Black Snake's Path, as well as a book of poetry, The Walking Man, and 15 scholarly essays. He lives in Frederick, Maryland. Gregory Smithers And I'm assuming we're going to go in the order here that I have, unless one of you wants to change that, is the author of The Cherokee Diaspora, An Indigenous History of Migration, Resettlement, and Identity. He's an associate professor of American Indian History at Virginia Commonwealth University, where he teaches courses on Indigenous history. Virginia Commonwealth is in Richmond, for the few of you who might not know that along the way. I married some Cherokee connections, so I'm particularly interested in that one. And Mary Stockwell joins us, the author of Other Trails?
A Trail.
Okay, Other Trail of Tears, PhD in American History. She has been a writer in the business world, a history professor, a department chair, a research fellow. Her history books for young people include Massachusetts, Our Home, 2005 winner of the Golden Lamp Award for Best Book. You can stay there or you can come up here and speak, whichever you prefer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. It's too bad we don't have a book about the struggle for the old Southeast, and then we'd have a perfect set of four that fills you in on the history of the Indians east of the Mississippi, really, from the 18th century into the sort of the middle of the 19th century. And so I hope you buy all three of these books. They really do complement each other. Mine is about the struggle, as the title is. And by the way, the Old Northwest is not Oregon. It's the area north of the Ohio River. It's Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin. And it's about the period 1770 to 1812. William Wells is someone who, unfortunately, is still pretty unknown, but he's really one of the major frontier figures of his time, and so I think I'll tell you a little bit about who he is. And also, you'll notice that my spur awards were in history, not biography, and so my book actually is a history of the period using Wells as a kind of focal point. Wells is very much tied into Virginia, by the way, and the story of the Wells family is very much the history of the frontier. They arrived in the early 17th century in the James River area, moved up to the Northern Neck, then moved to western Pennsylvania, and in 1779, the family flatboated down to Louisville. They were among the very first settlers in Louisville, settled on Beargrass Creek. And my first chapter is called Life and Death on Beargrass Creek, that talks about their life there. And that's when Kentucky is still part of Virginia, so we're still in Virginia history. When Wells was 13 in 1784, he was captured by the Eel River Miami Indians and taken up to what was called Snakefish Town near Logansport, Indiana. And there he was taught to become a Miami Indian. He learned to hunt. He became a warrior. He took an Indian wife. He raided flatboats along the Ohio River, went on raids into Kentucky, and then fought at the side of his father-in-law, the great Miami war chief Little Turtle, at two of the biggest battles the Indians ever fought. And the latter, St. Clair's defeat, is the biggest victory the Indians ever won against the U.S. Army. Now, the fact that probably this is first-time information for all of you, indicates how much this part of American history has been neglected. And so that's why this story is sort of doubly important. So Wells fought at St. Clair's defeat in 1791. In a raid later that year, his family was captured by the Americans. He then came to Cincinnati to try to arrange their release, and also at that time agreed to switch sides and help negotiate a treaty for their release in Vincennes, Indiana, which was accomplished in 1792. At that point, General Putnam realized how exceptional Wells was. He was pretty much the only person on the frontier who knew the Indian side of things. And so he offered him a handsome amount of money for the time to become a spy for the Americans. And at first he was a spy, but the term spy means scout as well. He spied on Indian councils up on the Maumee River for 2 years, 1792 to 1793, and then came back to Cincinnati and reported to General Anthony Wayne, who had replaced St. Clair after that terrible defeat. And Wayne also realized how exceptional Wells was, and so hired him as his head scout. And in this subsequent Battle of Fallen Timbers in 1794, Wells led the contingent up. What was the reason why, you might say, St. Clair didn't get ambushed and defeated is because Wells and his scouts made that pretty much impossible. And Wells gave crucial advice about how to conduct the battle. And Wayne won that battle, the Battle of Fallen Timbers. The following year, Wells was the interpreter at the Treaty of Greenville, in which most of Ohio was ceded to the Indians. The cover of my book pictures Wells in the middle at the Treaty of Greenville with his father-in-law, Little Turtle, on one side, and his commander-in-chief, Wayne, on the other side. So this picture captures why Wells is so important. He's in the middle of everything. And so as I tell his life story, I tell the story of all the major events on the frontier from both the Indian and the white points of view. After that treaty, Wells became the Indian agent for the Miami. It's interesting that they still respected him enough to want him to be their agent, even after he had betrayed them. And he was married to Sweet Breeze, Little Turtle's daughter. And as the Indian agent at Fort Wayne, he's in the middle of everything controversial on the frontier at that time. One of the most controversial things, in fact, two of the most controversial things, come out of a guy named Thomas Jefferson that you probably never heard of. The two things were, one, Jefferson's land policy, and the second thing is Jefferson's civilizing the Indians policy. And because Jefferson was so important to Wells, I devote a great deal of space to analyzing who Jefferson was, what his Indian policy was, what his civilizing the Indians policy was, and how those actually played out on the frontier in terms of Miami. Wells finds himself in the middle of all these things. He doesn't approve of Jefferson's civilization program, which mainly involved hiring the Quakers, because he thinks he and Little Turtle can do it better. He doesn't approve of Jefferson's land-grabbing policy because, of course, it's taking land away from the Indians so rapidly. Ironically, he's also helping Jefferson do these policies by being his Harrison's interpreter, etc. So he's very much in the middle. He actually helps the Americans do treaties, and then he encourages the Indians to protest against the very treaties he's helped to make. Needless to say, this doesn't make him very popular with anybody. And Jefferson's most ambitious treaty, the Treaty of Fort Wayne in 1809, was the one that really went over the edge and infuriated Tecumseh and his brother, the Shawnee Prophet, and they began to organize on multiple levels, both as a religious movement and as a military movement, against these treaties. And Wells is warning the Americans about what this means to them, and they don't particularly want to hear that news because it's just not favorable news, you might say. So Wells is in the middle between the administration, first Jefferson and then Madison, vis-a-vis Tecumseh and the rising militancy out there. He's trying to keep the Miami out of that Confederacy. All this leads up to the War of 1812, which, as you may be aware, was an extremely bungled war at the start. We pretty much did everything wrong you can do wrong in preparation for this war. One of the things we did wrong is we failed to tell the frontier we were going to war. And that meant that the British knew, before we knew, that hostilities had broken out, and the British immediately attacked our most exposed outposts, Mackinac in northern Michigan, and secondly, Fort Dearborn in Chicago. Now, the commander of Fort Dearborn was married to Wells's niece, and when Wells learned that fort was surrounded, he went out with 30 Miami warriors from Fort Wayne to try to negotiate an evacuation. And Wells got there. It was very clear the warriors were very angry. Wells negotiated with them. He got angry too, I'm sorry to say. And that didn't improve matters. And nonetheless, an evacuation was arranged. And the 96-some people in the fort, 60 of them sort of half soldiers, half militia, and the rest women and children, marched out of the fort in the morning. And about a mile or two from the fort, and again, the fort was right in downtown Chicago, Michigan Avenue, where the Chicago River crosses, if you know the area, and they were ambushed. Wells sort of saw the ambush coming, waved his hat, and helped heal to organize a kind of resistance. But they were outnumbered. There were hundreds of warriors in the sand dunes in those days along the coast. And Wells was killed in the battle, as were about 60 of the people involved. So it was known for a long time as the Chicago Massacre. Wells Street that runs through the center of Chicago is named for him. And in Fort Wayne, there's a Wells Avenue and a Spy Run that are also named for him. And there's a Wells County in Indiana named for him. So at least in certain places, he's known. I like to say I'm famous in Fort Wayne because when I go there, the Wells name rings a bell. So anyway, so my book presents, in other words, the larger picture here from about 1770, when Wells is born on the Western Pennsylvania frontier, to the very start of the War of 1812, when he is killed. I actually go on a little bit more about the War of 1812, since his brother Sam, which is kind of sub-story, is very interesting, played a major role in those early battles on the Ohio frontier during the War of 1812. And then his family moved to Missouri. So in other words, you have a biography and a history combined with lots of commentary on Eastern politics as well, since Wells takes delegations to meet not only Washington, but also Jefferson and Adams. So there are treaty negotiations and et cetera that he's doing back in Philadelphia and then in Washington that are also part of the book. So you really get the big picture as well as learn for the first time this story of William Wells. Thank you.
We're going to have each one speak, and then we will have questions, discussion after that.
Sounds great.
So, Gregory Smithers.
Thank you all for coming this morning. It's lovely to be on a panel with such distinguished colleagues, so this is a real treat for me. I wrote a book called The Cherokee Diaspora, and over the month since it was published in September last year, I was asked why I wrote the book. And I originally answered that question by giving a fairly boring kind of scholarly type answer, which as I realized later wasn't really satisfactory. That answer went something like this. I would explain to people that I'm an ethnohistorian. Ethnohistory is the combination of anthropological methodologies and historical methodologies. And that's something that, you know, I can see your eyes glazing over, means nothing to anyone except us. So I sort of thought about that, how the sort of inadequacy of that answer one night coming home from a book event in Washington, D.C., and I realized that that really doesn't give justice to where this book of mine began. It actually began in Australia when I was in the seventh grade. Now, I'm originally from Australia. I'm one of these troublemaking immigrants that you often hear about in the news. Dangerous ideas. And my wife's American. My kids are growing up American. But I grew up in Australia, so I have a very different... I have an outsider's sensibility to understanding American history and American history sources. But in the seventh grade, I had a friend who claimed to be descended from Cherokee Indians. And I thought that was complete nonsense at the time. And it's only in subsequent years that I've thought about that, and then having done the research for this book, that I realized there might actually have been something to his story. In fact, the very first anecdote that I begin the Cherokee diaspora with is a story of a family who tries to migrate to Australia in 1965. The wife and the mother of that family, her name is Cherokee Meeks. She was a mixed-race Cherokee woman who married a white man in eastern Oklahoma, and they were trying to migrate to Australia, to northern Queensland, in fact, where at the time in the early and mid-1960s, that's still very much frontier territory in Australia, and they needed farmers, and they needed skilled farmers. And the Meeks family seemed to fit that bill. However, Australia had something you might have heard of for much of the 20th century. In fact, from its founding in 1901 as a federated nation until 1972, Australia's immigration policy was defined by something that is referred to as the White Australia Policy. And when government officials discovered that Cherokee Meeks was mixed-race Cherokee, that also meant her children were mixed-race Native American, their application went south very fast, and they were denied admission. And when I found that document, I thought back to that seventh-grade encounter, to that friend of mine who claimed to have Cherokee ancestry. Well, maybe he wasn't so full of baloney as I had originally thought. And this is what really started me on the path, trying to figure out the magnitude, the extent to which Cherokee people have migrated around the world, not just throughout North America, but throughout the Americas, across the Atlantic, to England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, continental Europe, and then all the way down into the Southwest Pacific. And in fact, I should point out that since publishing this book, I've had people emailing me and contacting me, thanking me for writing the story, but can you please talk about my relatives in Micronesia who have mixed-race Cherokee ancestry, or in northern Scotland who have mixed-race Cherokee ancestry. The list goes on and on and on. The federal census, the last federal census, back in 2010, estimated that there's a little under a million Americans who self-identify as part Cherokee. I would suggest to you, given the number of people who have come up to me and said they are either part Cherokee or married to Cherokee people, that that number must be on the low end of the estimate scale, because everywhere I travel, people either know, have relations with, or are themselves, according to their family histories, part Cherokee. Now, when I originally approached this story, I thought this must have all begun with the Trail of Tears, what we know today as the Trail of Tears. And in the book, I talk about the contested nature of that phrase and where it comes from and how people debated its origins and its meaning. But as I continued to dig deeper into the archives and the oral histories of the Cherokee people, I discovered that that's part of the story. It's a major part of the story. It's a major narrative pivot point upon which modern Cherokee people narrate their histories in relation to the United States. But there's a much longer, deeper history of movement, travel, migration and relocation that the Cherokee people are a part of. And that history goes back really to Cherokee oral tradition and what we used to call mythology. Those tales that define the Cherokee people and who they are, who their communities are, what defines a sense of belonging, within them contain stories about how their ancient ancestors migrated from a distant land, in some cases from a mysterious island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and eventually settled about 4,000 years ago in the southeast, in the Appalachian region of the modern United States. So travel always had something to do with Cherokee history, and it had something intimately to do with how the Cherokees understood themselves and their ancestors. It gave Cherokee people a sense of why and how important the land that they came to occupy was in the southeast, but it also gave them a sense of the circularity of historical time. It gave them a sense of the importance of direction and what direction meant culturally in Cherokee history. And it was ultimately a history that came back into vogue during the 18th century, Cherokee people reconnecting with those traditions of migration and travel. Because it's in the context of settler colonialism, the competition between the British, the French, and the Spanish in particular, that Cherokee leaders and townspeople find themselves fighting for, in some cases, their survival as a people. They're fighting to maintain control of the land and the waterways that have given sustenance to their life for many thousands of years. Over the course of the 18th century, Cherokee landholdings contracted and contracted quite dramatically. And this led to the first wave of migrations within what we know today, or what scholars know today, as Cherokee Country. This is a vast swath of land that extends through southwestern Virginia, up through Tennessee and Kentucky, down through parts of Alabama, includes parts of Georgia, North and South Carolina. It's an immense territory. Not all of that territory was inhabited. Part of it was used as a buffer zone against rival groups and tribal nations, and was also used as a hunting ground. Where men could go out and be men and perform their masculine duties and responsibilities in terms of hunting and so forth. But it's in the 18th century, to get back to my story, that Cherokee landholdings contract and contract dramatically. So there's this first wave of migration that goes on within that vast territory. And, pardon me, Cherokee people form new towns within Cherokee territory in response to the pressures that are coming to bear and the violence that's coming to bear on them from European settlers. When we get to the period of the Seven Years' War during the 1750s and early 1760s, and then the decades leading through the American Revolution, we have even more dramatic movement and migration among Cherokee people. Some Cherokee people decide that they have had enough with these violent Europeans who keep encroaching upon their towns and keep causing such destruction on many levels that they decide at the end of the 18th century to migrate to the Trans-Mississippi West. Now, this was a very brave move on the part of Cherokee people. The West was known as the darkening place or the darkening lands in Cherokee oral tradition. And darkness and blackness was associated with death in Cherokee culture. So to make this decision in that context gives you a sense of how desperate some of these families and communities felt in responding to and trying to get away from the pressures of by the end of the 18th century, American settler colonialism. This is not to say that the Trans-Mississippi West was unknown to Cherokee people at this point. It wasn't. There was a well-established network of trade routes, both overland and water routes, that connected the Southeast with the Southwest, and scholarship is still developing our understanding of those networks. And Cherokee men also would periodically travel to the Trans-Mississippi West to hunt. But this was new, what was going on in the late 18th century. There were entire Cherokee families and kinship networks that were migrating into what was known as the Arkansas Territory and into Spanish Texas. And they came into conflict with both Europeans on those frontiers and they came into conflict with other indigenous people who had long occupied those lands in the Trans-Mississippi West. So it wasn't easy then, as I talk about in the book, to be part of the vanguard of the Cherokee diaspora in the late 18th century. And it is indeed that vanguard and their offspring that greet Cherokee people as they are forcibly relocated from their homelands in the Southeast during the 1830s. But one of the things then that is also important that I want to sort of emphasize and that I talk about in the book is that Cherokee history does not end with the Trail of Tears. In many ways, it's a new beginning with the Trail of Tears. And there's a couple of reasons for that which I discuss in the book, and I hope you'll find it up the back there after we finish talking. Hint, hint. The first is the Cherokee people, once relocated into Indian Territory or modern-day eastern Oklahoma, had the very difficult task of rebuilding their nation. And so what you see developing and what I detail in the book is the emergence of two homelands for the Cherokee people. One is this artificial, politically constructed homeland in Indian Territory, and the other is this ancestral homeland, and they talk about it in that language as well, in the mountains of North Carolina. And both of these homelands are very important to giving, to structuring and anchoring a sense of Cherokee identity, because the movement and migration of Cherokee people does not stop in the late 1830s. In fact, it continues all through the late 19th century and through the 20th century and indeed into our present. And the reasons for that are multifaceted. Often it has to do with the search for employment opportunities, but it also has to do with other issues such as an attempt to try and reconnect with family members and loved ones who have migrated throughout the world for various reasons. So the Cherokee diaspora then is something that is constantly in a state of flux and creation and recreation, and that's a point that I try to make in the book. And these two homelands that emerge in the 19th century help to anchor that sense of being a Cherokee in diaspora. The other thing that helps, and I'll perhaps leave the floor on this note, is literacy. Cherokee people have always been interested in language and words. Their oral traditions are very dynamic. And in the early 19th century, thanks to Sequoyah, the famous inventor of the Cherokee syllabary, which is an alphabet that the Cherokee people still use, the Cherokee people used language to remain connected to family, to friends, to communities. Cherokee people go off to fight in, for example, the First and Second World War, in both European and Pacific theaters. And they send letters home to their relatives who may happen to live in Ohio or California or Utah. And often those letters are bilingual. It's extraordinary. They're written in both the Cherokee language and in English. Now, sometimes it's just a character or two in Cherokee, because the language does come under serious assault from the American government and its effort to assimilate Native Americans into the, quote, mainstream in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But nonetheless, these letters and the development of an epistolary culture over the course of the 19th and 20th century reinforce how important it is to remain connected to community. And Cherokee people, in the process of engaging in this bilingualism in written form, are trying to keep that sense of community alive. And I've heard stories recently, giving book talks around the country and here in Virginia, of people who tell me that they continue to do the same thing, writing letters to loved ones, Cherokee loved ones throughout the country and other parts of the world, to remain connected and to keep a sense of Cherokee community alive, if only in their minds, if not in reality. So it really is an extraordinary history that I ultimately stumbled across many years ago, and it made me think, as I said, driving back from Washington, D.C. just before Christmas last year, that maybe that friend of mine wasn't so full of it as I thought he was at the time, and maybe I should make an effort to reach out and say, I'm sorry for making fun of you. But thank you.
Thank you. Mary Stockwell is next on our program. Look forward to hearing from you as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the Virginia Book Festival for inviting me. It's quite an honor. I'm happy to be here. I always say Ohio, where I'm from, is just Virginia over the mountains.
Used to be the case, yes.
Yes. I don't know if you've noticed, but we're in a presidential election season. And I am going to give you great power right now. I want you to imagine that you've just been elected president of the United States. You took it very well. I didn't see anyone passing out or anything. Not in 2016, in 1816. Let me tell you the world that you're facing, especially over those mountains towards Ohio. There's just been a horrific war that you talked about. a terrible war. The war that we just remember by its name, the War of 1812, but it was a war that tore up the entire West because a young man by the name of Tecumseh rose up and decided he was going to unite all the Indians and he was going to fight for the old Ohio country as an Indian nation. And the British joined him, many Indians joined him, many Indians despised him. But that conflict, his dream, helped launch the War of 1812, which was a bloodbath out on the Western frontier. It's forgotten now in our history books, but it was terrible from Wisconsin all the way down through Michigan, Ohio, all the way to Alabama. People fought, and it was terrible. And Tecumseh almost won, but he was defeated. He was defeated, but when the British, who were his allies, got to the peace negotiations at Ghent, they said, "We're not ending this war until you hand over the old Ohio country to the Indians, and you give them that Indian nation as their own." And in the midst of these negotiations, the British also burned down the capital of the United States. You've gotten out of that mess. You've gotten out of that war. That war's over. You got the Ohio country. You have peace with the British, and you have signed dozens and dozens and dozens of treaties with the Indians who were in Tecumseh's Confederation. And you promise peace, peace, peace forever. No more war. We're not going to kill each other. These great colonial wars are over. We're going to live in peace together. Sound good? Doing good so far. You don't seem to have any trouble so far. All right. Oh, but you also happen to be the representative of all these people who want to come over those mountains to get that land. Because you're not in the party of the 1%, you're in the party of the 99%. And you're not for the bankers, you're not for Wall Street, which was starting. You're not Hamilton, you're in the Jefferson crowd. And you've promised all this free land, or very cheap land, to the American people whom you represent. And they're going to go out there into that Western country where you've just promised all this peace, and they're going to expect land open up for them for a dollar or two an acre. What would you do if you're president of the United States? Because I did just elect all of you. You have to think about it. There'll be a quiz later. One of the best things about being a professor was you could stand up in front of a room and you could just pummel those poor students with one question after another. You didn't have to answer them. But that question is the starting point of my book, The Other Trail of Tears, because it starts with James Monroe. Not Andrew Jackson, but James Monroe. James Monroe is elected president, and he wants peace with the British, and he signs peace treaties with the Indians, and he wants to open the West for settlement. And he has to come up with a way to do that. And he does. Let me tell you what he does. He says, "My plan out in the West is this. We're going to go meet with the Indians. We're going to buy the land from them. We're going to give them annuities. But I'm going to do something that nobody else has done before. I'm going to carve out reserves." Reserves? Hey, media guy. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can do it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Take a look at this. He decides to use Northwest Ohio as the test ground for a new plan. He's going to allow the Indians to stay in this land that he's going to open up for settlement, and he carves out reserves with them. In 1817, there's a huge treaty signed at a place called the Foot of the Rapids, where terrible battles had been fought. Fallen Timbers was fought down the way. They fought here in the War of 1812, and all the Ohio tribes, the Delaware, Seneca, Shawnee, Ottawa, and Wyandotte, are given big swatches of land that are carved out according to the Land Ordinance of 1785. They get really good land. They get the premier farmland of Northwest Ohio. And what Madison Monroe says is, this is going to be yours, and we, the government, will protect you, and we'll give you anything you need. I'm going to set up a civilization fund. If you need to know more about commercial farming, if you want schools, if you want churches, you come to the government, and we will help you. And eventually, you will look and act like the rest of us. We'll all be in this modern 19th century world together. And when those American settlers get up to the edges of your reserves, you'll all look alike and act alike, and we'll blend together in one happy family. Do you like what he did? I'm seeing a lot of no. I have to tell you this. When I discovered this about James Monroe, I said, who knew James Monroe did anything but the Monroe Doctrine? That's the only thing I remember about him. When I look at this, I say, this is kind of a brave thing to do. At least he's trying. He's trying to say, we've got to find a way, after killing each other for centuries, to live together. I'm going to flip it now. I'm going to make you something else. Mm-hmm. You're not the president anymore. Mm-hmm. You're a chief of one of these tribes. Imagine yourself a chief of the Delaware, Seneca, Shawnee, Ottawa, and Wyandot. And you've now been given this huge reserve. There are many reserves. And you've been told, you know, this is what's going to happen, but we're here to help you, and you can stay here forever, and we'll be one great people. What would you do? Are you a blender? Let's do it. Move. Get all the tribes together and do what? That's an idea, because you're still allowed to be an independent nation. You're not going to be blended in right away. But you're certainly not going to go to war again. The days of Tecumseh are over. One thing I should add this, and this is something that I saw as I was writing this book, a theme emerged. Time is so ever-present in anything that is American. We don't realize how we are driven by time. Got to get this done. Got to get the schedule done. Tomorrow is another day, as Scarlett O'Hara said. We've got to plan. We've got to do. We've got to grow. Think of your day, how much of it is already planned and laid out across time. This is not just us. It goes back. It goes back across that frontier. And what I noticed was that when this was set up, there's a theme that runs through everything you read. From the 1816, 1817, 1818, 1819, you've only got so much time. And it's almost as if the Indians are put on this invisible clock, and you must change, and you must adapt, and you've got to hurry, because we're coming your way. So you're under immense pressure to transform, almost overnight, to blend in with the wider culture coming your way. What I discovered was, and this amazed me, because we tend to write our history, Indian does this, white man does this, like we're all one great monolith. In the central section of the book, I talk about what was it like to be a Delaware, Seneca, Shawnee, Ottawa, and Wyandot when you're on these reserves. And what I discovered is they all see things differently. The Delaware said, you've got to be kidding. We're supposed to stay on these little pieces of ground and transform ourselves into copies of you. We are leaving. They left, and guess where they go? They're going with the Cherokee in Arkansas. The Delaware are gone by 1821, long before Andrew Jackson has even become president. They leave and they go to Arkansas and they say, we will retain our identity. We're going to be Delaware. And what you just said, and we'll have that huge Indian nation in Arkansas. And the Delaware starts saying, everybody gather in Arkansas, and we'll be a great, great Indian nation. No war, but Tecumseh's dream will live. Would you have gone with them? Think about it. I'm cowardly. I tend to stay where I am. I don't think I would have been brave enough to go with the Delaware. I would have said, oh, let's take a chance with Monroe. The Seneca are given a huge swatch of ground in now Sandusky, Ohio, 40,000 square acres, black, black soil. You should go there in the springtime and see that black soil. And the Seneca say this. They go, we're going to stay here. We're going to be the greatest commercial farmers you've ever seen. People will ooh and ah when they come on our property, but we retain our identity. Don't send us missionaries. Don't send us priests. Stay away. Because we are Seneca in our hearts, even though we might look like you outside. Shawnee split in two. Tecumseh's tribe split in two, half left. Half just walked out to Arkansas and to Kansas and said, we don't want any part of this being little mini Americans. But half stayed, and they said, send us money, send us Quakers, send us anything. We're going to be the best farmers ever, and when you catch up to our reserves, you will be so proud of us, we'll be able to stay here forever. The Ottawa live along the Maumee River where I live, They just laughed. They said, nobody's going to want to live along the Maumee River. It's a swamp. And they said, we can be ourselves. You don't have to do anything. And they just continued as if nothing was happening. And the Wyandotte, they got the most tremendous piece of ground called the Grand Reserve. It's now Upper Sandusky, Ohio. One of my favorite things to do in Ohio is to go out into farm country and see this beautiful land. If you would drive past Upper Sandusky today, they're turning over the blackest, flattest, richest soil in the world. And that's what the Wyandotte get. And half of them say, we're going to stay. We're going to do everything we possibly can. We'll convert to Christianity. We'll inside and out. We'll be the best people. And you'll respect us when you get up to the edge of our reserves. And the other half said, we'll stay. But we're going to hate every minute of it. Because we are not giving up our Wyandotte identity. Against us, when I write history, I'd like to lay those questions in and kind of force my reader to put themselves in that position of what would you have done? Because we try so hard, I know, to say this is what happened. This happened, this happened, this happened. But no historian writes without a story reverberating in the background. What might have been? What else could have happened? If I had chosen differently, what would have happened? And that, to me, stays alive in this tremendous story. One thing that I started to feel as I'm getting, maybe now I'm arcing the books about halfway through, you begin to hear this quiet drumbeat behind the scenes where people begin to say, time is running out. Time is running out for this grand experiment. And you don't necessarily hear it from the people of Ohio. The people of Ohio are not like the people of Georgia. They're not demanding that the Indians get out. But there's a quiet drumbeat coming from the Indians themselves. I would say half of the Indians who stay behind begin to complain to the U.S. government, and they say this, we're very decent people. We're working hard. We're trying to make this work. But the people who are filtering out onto the frontier are not your best. They are drunks. They are criminals. They are diseased. You know, in our minds, we might have this frontier mentality that the best people go first in their covered wagons. That's not what happens. The worst people go first.
Yeah.
people who want to sell whiskey, people who are criminals, people who steal from the Indians, people truly who are diseased and bring trouble all and violence out into the West. And you start to hear petitions coming into the U.S. government, especially from the Seneca, begging the President of the United States to send them west, to get them away from the Americans, because they said, this blending will never work because you are too violent and you're too cruel and you're going to destroy us with whiskey. Some Indians even write to the White House and say, why don't you stop producing whiskey? Your whole nation is drunk. You're trying to make us drunk. How about we quit drinking? I every time I see a beer commercial, I think of that. A few business leaders started to protest, too. They started to say, you know, these Indians are so old-fashioned. If we could get them out of the Maumee River Valley, we'd have a big city like Toledo, where I live right now. A lot of people who had been on the frontier for a long time, the old Indian agents, started to say this. People like William Clark, Lewis Cass, do you remember the good old days when the American Indians were men? They were manly men who hunted. They were manly men who went to war. A lot of the old-timers out on the frontier, they said, remember when they were so frightening that they almost tore the Western country apart? Now we're trying to turn them into farmers. Why? Now, so many young men, broken that they could no longer be warriors and leaders in their people, were coming into the American towns, falling down drunks. So a lot of the Indian agents are writing back to Washington saying, this is wrong. If God made them to be free and independent, to be hunters and warriors, let them go across the Mississippi River. Let them go. Dad, you're president again. What if you're president and you've tried for your whole term, two terms, to get everybody to live together in this grand experiment, only to be flooded with petitions from Indians and whites saying, this isn't working. Save those people and ship them across the Mississippi River. Would you have been strong and said, no, we're going to continue? I don't care if this is everybody's complaining. Or would you do what Monroe did at the end of his presidency? I failed. I quit. The first president to recommend removal of the Eastern tribes to across the Mississippi was James Monroe. And he said, it's not working. And he said, this collision of peoples on the frontier is more damaging to the Indians than it is to the whites. They're coming in record numbers. They're going to tumble over. The drunkards will go first, but the farmers will follow them. And he recommended it, and Congress said no. John Quincy Adams recommends removal of the Indians for that same reason. He had a wonderful man from Virginia as his Secretary of War, one of my heroes I discovered. And if you read the sections on James Barber, you're going to say, Stockwell stopped being a historian. She has found a hero. So I wish a statue would be built to him. He was a Secretary of War under John Quincy Adams, and he came up with this remarkable plan. He said, I got an idea. How about we go to every Indian tribe out there, we go to every village, and we ask them the startling question, what would you like to do? Would you want to stay? What do you need? We'll give it to you. Want to go? Where do you want to go? We'll send you. We'll help you. And then he envisioned that across the Mississippi River, there'd be two huge territories, one up by Wisconsin, one down by Arkansas. All the Indians could go there, live any way they wanted, but they would begin the three-step process of becoming states in the Union. Live the life you want, but become citizens down the road. James Barber still thought there was time. There's time to fix this. We don't have to fix everything now. The future can be better, even if it takes a long time to get there. And he's thrown out of office along with John Quincy Adams and the whole crowd in 1828 when Andrew Jackson is elected. One thing I discovered with my theme of time was that Andrew Jackson was the timekeeper. And he said, time's up. It's over. This century-long debate about who should live where is over. You want to stay on this side of the Mississippi River? Then you give up your Indian identity. All these reserves are going to disappear. You're going to have to join the American system right now. Your laws are gone. All that land that you're not using, much of it's going to be opened up for settlement to the people who voted for me. Stay. If you want to be who you are, go. That was the Indian Removal Act of 1830. I'm going to give you one last question. Now what would you do? If you're Delaware, Seneca, Shawnee, Ottawa, Wyandotte, these are the closing chapters of my book, what do you do if you get a proposition like that thrown at you? I can stay in Ohio. I'm just going to lose my identity. I'm going to be like the Irish who are starting to trickle in, my ancestors. You're just going to be blending in with the rest of the people. You'll remember your heritage, not like you described it, with all this Cherokee language and all that. You'll be Wyandotte, Seneca, Otto, Wyandotte, like I'm Irish and English. We'll blend into a greater whole. Would you have done that, or would you have said, we're going out across into that dark Western world, and we're going to keep our nations together? I think that's a frightening question. Like I said, when I'm writing, it's like reverberating. I like to think that my reader is putting himself in the story and saying, what would I have done at that place? Let me leave you with two things, just kind of the closing of the book. What happens when Andrew Jackson now starts to send all of his emissaries out there to write treaties, to buy this land, and to ship everyone west? One thing I have to say for Ohio, I was besmirched as an Ohioan as I came up here by a Michigander. The people of Ohio were not like the people of Georgia. They did not want this. The two senators from Ohio voted against Jackson. Every representative in Congress who had an Indian reserve in his district voted against Indian removal, even if they were Jackson supporters. People in Ohio wrote the best petitions I have ever read to the Congress of the United States. If you go online and you type in Ladies of Steubenville, you will read what 62 girls at an academy in Steubenville, Ohio, wrote to the Congress and through the Congress to Andrew Jackson. And they said, do not do this. Might make sense now, but this is going to be a scar on the American psyche, and we're never going to heal it. And we're going to look bad in the eyes of the world. And they said something interesting, too. They go, you know, we're white women, and white men tell us what to do because they keep telling us they're doing this for our good, because they're smarter than us. You're dealing with men. You can't say the same thing to Indian men. You're all the same. You can't push men around the way you can push women around. Might be a twisted argument there, but it was pitiful as these girls begged, don't do this. The other thing I want to leave you with is nobody rolled over and played dead when Jackson said, you're going. Each one of these tribes had to make a conscious decision what to do, and they all decided differently. And when you study their removal, and that's what the ending of the book is about, as each one of these tribes leaves Ohio, they often decide among themselves as a people that they're leaving, but not because they're being pushed out, but because they've decided it is time to go. The Seneca leave. One of the main reasons they leave is the local law authorities have been coming onto the Seneca Reserve and telling them, you can't use capital punishment. You know, you can't have trials and condemn people to death. That's not what we do in Ohio. The Seneca have to take it all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court to okay their right to rule their reserve the way they want to. But they start to say, if every time we make a move, we end up in the Ohio State Supreme Court, it's time to go. And they leave. The Shawnee leave too. They're brokenhearted. Half of them are already gone, including the prophet, the Shawnee, Tecumseh's brother. But their great leader dies. I was thinking of William Wells, who has a tie to the past. Their great leader, Black Hoof, who has been leading them since the French and Indian War, dies in 1831. And they say, our tie to the Ohio country is over. It's time to go with the younger chiefs who are saying, let's go west and try again. The Ottawa, I love the Ottawa. They just run up and down the Maumee River and they said, nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. We don't have to decide. We can just pretend this isn't happening. Whenever the negotiators round up the Ottawa, they act like they don't know. We never heard of Jackson. We never heard of this. What are you talking about? But finally, by 1837 and 1839, when so many of the older people are dead, either from drunkenness, from disease, and they've got about 80% young people. The chiefs who are alive say, our children will die here. We might as well take a chance on Oklahoma and Kansas, and they leave. The Wyandotte, who end the book, are an amazing people. The Wyandotte have tried harder than anybody to stay in Ohio. If you go out onto the Wyandotte Reserve in 1840, 1841, 42, 43, they've tried for 12 years to fight Jackson, you would think you were on some English estate. And people come to it and they say, this must be wealthy landed lords who somehow landed in Ohio. They are probably the wealthiest, most successful businessmen and farmers in Ohio. And I'm convinced they could have fought it a lot longer. And maybe like the Seneca up in New York, they could have stayed. But one of their brilliant young chiefs, a young man by the name of Samundawat, who had believed with all his heart that Monroe was right, we could all live in peace together, he was murdered by drunken hunters out on a hunting trip. And when Samundawat died, the Wyandotte took a vote and slightly more said, it's time to go. This dream we had is over. The Wyandotte are the only tribe who got no money from the government. They had nobody going with them. They hired the wagons. They hired the buggies. They packed their bags. They went west on their own by steamboat. And when they got out west, they picked the country they wanted to live in. They went totally on their own. I have to say one, let me say one last thing. I promise. Waves of nostalgia then come over everybody. And everybody seems to regret that this has happened, the people who stay back in Ohio. The Indians themselves don't seem to regret it. There's a famous Wyandotte by the name of Chief Gray Eyes, and he tells all the people who are weeping in Upper Sandusky, aren't you Christians? Isn't there life after death? Even the best life in this world, we have to leave. And they go on. And I kind of think what's sad about this is I think it's in many respects harder for all of us who are not of Indian descent to accept this. Because guess what? We got what was left behind. My ancestors, poverty-stricken from Ireland, came and they settled on the big Ottawa Reserve at the mouth of the Maumee River. Nobody wanted the Irish, but they got the Indian country. My Bohemian ancestors came from a tiny town called Sazava, and they got the land out in Kansas. They eventually settled out on the Kansas land of the Shawnee. I'm going to leave you with one thing and one thing only, and that is it's not just a story of the past and time, it's a story of democracy, because who wins and who loses, and how do we make that decision? Who gets what? That's a decision not just for the past, the present, and the future. I'm sorry I talked too long, but I'm Irish.
Two comments from the two of you. And meanwhile, if you have questions, we have a few minutes here, but not many at this point. So, you want to go first?
Oh, no, let's go right to questions. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have two questions on the Mizbeth and on the Gregory.
On the Cherokee, were there any treaties we had with the Indians that were kept besides with the one with the small group of Gualla Indians?
Do you know
what word I like to use instead of treaty? Truce. It's almost as if there was fighting to a point. And then there was a truce, and we make promises to each other. And almost immediately, once those promises are made on who gets what, where we're all going to live, you see more people moving in and wanting to cross those barriers and cross those borders. And then conflict breaks out. Up until the War of 1812, it's war. But after that, it's just conflict. Government steps in again, writes another truce. And so it's, I think that the American demand for land was too great for treaties to be kept.
The Gualla fought very hard to extract land rights out of the federal government. What happened after the period of removal is the federal government and the state of North Carolina said that you can stay here on your ancestral lands, but you have to become citizens of the state of North Carolina. And that really didn't jibe well with Cherokee leaders or ordinary Cherokee people up in the mountains. So they align themselves. One of the things Cherokees do very well is they align themselves with the best lawyers in the country, and they send off their own best and brightest to become lawyers to represent the Cherokee people. And that's ultimately what happens. So the Cherokee, the Gualla Cherokee, actually resist effectively termination and assimilation during the 20th century. In a way that most other native peoples throughout the United States are unable to do, including the Cherokee Nation.
I understand that. I thought that their treaty was with the state of Georgia, not the U.S. government.
But that was a problem because the state of Georgia tried to act independently of the government. And no, the federal government has always said it's the nation that deals with the Indian tribes.
Yeah,
so Georgia was kind of acting on its own.
The issue with Georgia relates specifically to the removal of the old Cherokee Nation in the late 1830s. And what you have there is really a precursor to issues of sectionalism that lead to the Civil War. The undergirding issue that pushes Cherokee people out is the expansion of the slave frontier, even though some Cherokees are slaves themselves. And what you have on the frontier in Georgia is a determination of white migrants to acquire slaves in the land that Cherokee people occupy. It's their form of upward social and economic mobility. So Georgia officials try to act on their behalf and in a way that is overreaching and contrary to federal
law.
Yeah.
Did you want to? Yeah, well, my autograph, Ms. Stockwell, in her teaching about the land acquisition, do you use the doctrine of discovery as a means that we use to take over Indian
land? You need to keep this to about 30 seconds.
No, not really. Let me answer as Jackson answered. We pretend that the Indians owned the land. We believe we owned it. Mm-hmm. And that's the legal reality.
Yes, sir, in the back.
Yes, it was mentioned earlier that Biden was an important part of the movement as well as the demography. And since the Native American culture favors the past where I came from and the future where I'm going, how would the language, there were three language groups you could think of in this Northeast area, Algonquin, Sioux, and Iroquois. How did this language, how would this language differences work out in the demographic?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting things about William Wells, of course, is that he, even though I think he went to maybe 1 year of high school at best, was quite gifted at languages. And so when he was captured by the Indians, he, of course, quickly picked up Miami, but also the related Delaware and Shawnee. But then, and those were the, so the dominant group in the Old Northwest is speaking not Iroquois, indeed, the Algonquin language. And the Mingo, as they were called, were the Seneca and the Wyandotte. Wells was able to communicate Indian Sign Language as one of the ways the Indians got across those language barriers. But Indians were pretty good at learning other languages as well. Far more Indians knew English, for example, than at least some English, than most people would assume, and they could communicate back and forth. So I don't recall real major problems with language barriers among the Indians themselves as they were trying to make clear what they intended to do.
Yeah, I just add to that quickly, if I can, and say that the Cherokee, for example, like other native Southerners, had a large group of interpreters among themselves. So they could cross linguistic boundaries with relative ease, and you see this in their diplomatic negotiations, not only with Europeans, but with also other native peoples.
Any questions from this side of the room here? Yes.
Just want to say thanks to Ohio for doing a lot of the work that we've done. But my question is in terms of identity of many of the tribes, particularly here in Virginia, where we have Laura Flecker, who changed the identity of some Native people to people of color, and I guess, you know, Europe is still surviving that. So genetically, the who is, you know, who is Native, who is not Native. So, you know, just kind of give your comments on that.
That's a big one.
Yeah, that's
how long have you got?
We have about 2 minutes here.
Just to answer it quickly, it is a huge issue. And in the southwest of Virginia, for example, because I'm most interested in the Cherokee, Plecker and his cohort of people, if you can call them that, were down there in the early 20th century. And they were very concerned about the long history of intermixing between the Monacan and the Cherokee and African Americans as well and the descendants of slaves. They were concerned it was creating these horrible populations of hybrids who were so frustrated because they didn't have any identity. So what's the way to go about fixing that where you create this racial binary? They're just colored.
Yes.
Well, Walter Plecker, who you just mentioned, was in charge of the Bureau of Vital Statistics.
That's correct.
And there were only black and white. And so they were trying to purify the white race. It's part of that 1920s thing. But
that's what Plecker thought he was doing.
Yes. And so any Indian in the state of Virginia who was born were classified either as black or white. They were trying to eliminate the Indians in this state with that kind of a ruling.
That's correct.
I need to bring this to a close. I'm sorry to say, because I think the conversation could go on at some length here. Karen Wood is going to be speaking about her own work tomorrow afternoon, and she probably knows more, well, she, from my perspective, she knows more than anybody else about the Virginia Indians and their community. She herself is a Monacan, a poet, and I would encourage you to come and join her tomorrow afternoon. Because it will be an exchange program. What time is it? It's 4 o'clock. At the Haven, which is downtown on Mark Street. close.